Let's look at... Oh, it's going to get worse today. Let's turn to Job chapter 34, please. Job chapter 34. We're going to have a little more of Elihu's speech this hour. Next hour, we'll move on to the speech of God to Job. So we've had the three friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, and they were just totally off base. Now we have Elihu, and by way of introduction, Elihu's speech, or what Elihu says, is the only one that's not reprimanded by God at the end of the book. The rest of them are. And God says, you asked Job to make sacrifices for you, but he doesn't for Elihu. So Elihu is closer to the mark than the other two. Now, what he's going to say in his advice is he's going to take a totally different approach. First of all, he's going to be courteous and tactful. And remember the others, well, they started out, Eliphaz started out somewhat tactful and courteously. He said, you know, if you possibly have a sin, then maybe you should tell God and things would get back to normal. And then Bildad got a little more severe, and Zophar just flat out told him, you're a stinking sinner, go get straight with it. Not in those words, of course, but he told him that. And they got worse through all three of the speeches. They call them the triad, the three speeches. And now Elihu is going to be courteous. He's going to be tactful. And he's going to be flexible. Look at 33:5, and we looked at this last week, but chapter 33 and verse 5 says, refute me if you can. Array yourselves before me and take your stand. So you say, I'm flexible. You know, if you can convince me that your doctrine is correct and mine is wrong, then I'm all ears. He has empathy for Job in verse 32 of chapter 33, where he says, then, if you have anything to say, answer me. Speak, for I desire to justify you. You know, the other three, they wanted it for them. You know, for their, hey, I'd put that Job in his place. But now Elihu's saying, I really want to help you. The other three ended up spitting on Job. Elihu says, I want to help. He also identifies with Job in verse 6. He says, behold, I belong to God like you. I too have been formed out of the clay. I mean, he doesn't put himself above Job like the other three had. He doesn't come speaking master to servant or teacher to student. He comes speaking, hey, I'm made out of clay just like you are. God made me just like he made you. So we're, as Red Green likes to put it, we're all in this together. You know, we're the same. So he's also sensitive. And if you look at 33:7, you see that when it says, behold, no fear of me should terrify you, nor should my pressure weigh heavily on you. He says, I'm not going to come here and just pound on you and tell you, you got to do this, you got to do that, and you got to do this, and you got to do that. I remember a teacher once up in Lincoln. He liked to teach prophecy, and his name was Jake Gertson, a wonderful old man. He's passed away now, but he used to always have that finger moving at you. You know, he said, yeah, it's this and that and this and that. It got to be kind of a trademark type thing. The most important point about Elihu and his argument is that it's centered in the issues. It didn't center in, you know, Job, you're suffering, therefore you sin. Elihu's going to get into the issues involved. And he's going to say that we have some doctrines here that we have to study a little further so we can understand this. And that's what they're going to do in verse 34. They're going to get a little more detailed. Elihu is, and he's going to tell Job, here are some of the doctrines that you have wrong. And to support it, he quotes what Job said. He says, now, Job, here is what you said, and you're wrong. In verses 1 through 9 of chapter 34, it says, then Elihu continued and said, hear my words, you wise men, and listen to me, you who know. For the ear tests words as the palate tastes food. Hey, is that a unique idea? We learn things by hearing them. That we communicate with words. I say that because in our culture, that it's becoming less and less. You know, words don't mean what they used to. A president of the United States comes to mind appearing before a judicial commission and parsing words and making them mean something other than they mean. Now, words have meaning. They're important. And that's why we use them and study them. That's why I'm so careful, especially in the New Testament, to use the right words. And when we get back to the New Testament, I think in 1 Corinthians next, I'm going to point out some of the words that appear differently in some of the 22,000 manuscripts that we have in the New Testament. And I'm going to show you the logic behind the word that was chosen by the translating committee. And then I'm going to give you my opinion, which they sometimes agree, usually agree. Sometimes they don't, though. I've had a few where I disagree with the committee, but we'll see, and I'll leave it up to you when I'll try to give you all the facts. But words are important. And he says the ear tests words just like the palate tastes food. Let us choose for ourselves what is right. Let us know among ourselves what is good. For Job has said, now here he's quoting Job. He said, Job, you said this. And I'm going to refute it. Job has said, I am righteous, but God has taken away my right. My wound is incurable, though I am without transgression. What man is like Job, who drinks up derision like water, who goes in company with the workers of iniquity, and walks with wicked men? For he has said, it profits a man nothing when he is pleased with God. Now, those are Job's words that Elihu is quoting. And as we pointed out last time, Elihu has pointed out Job's misconceptions of God. Job has some erroneous viewpoints about God, and Elihu's going to point them out to him. For example, he viewed God as one who is not guided by steady judgment. God is changeable, in other words. He's not immutable is the doctrinal word. He's not immutable. He changes. You know, his judgment isn't guided by purpose. It's whimsical, you might say. He viewed God as one who acts without a standard, doesn't have a norm, displays erratic, unpredictable conduct. And that's what Job said, as you recall. He also viewed God as being silent. And this is where Elihu came in and said, and if you were here, you'll remember, he said, you'd say God is silent? Man, he's screaming at you by your pain. Through your pain. You're supposed to learn something from that pain. God isn't silent. He's screaming. Now, he's not going to say anything, but he's going to make his point that God is screaming his message through pain. 33:14. Indeed, God speaks once or twice, yet no one notices it. In a dream, in a vision of the night, when sound sleep falls on men, while they slumber in their beds, he opened the ears of men and seals their instructions, that he may turn man aside from his conduct and keep man from pride. Well, it came to the point of a lot more than just dreams and visions for Job. He's going to teach him the hard way. Some of us have to learn the hard way, as I'm sure many of you know. And some of us just don't listen. It's like the 2x4 across the head just to get his attention. That's what God is doing to Job. So he is teaching him something. You know, pain is one factor. And I'm sure many of you know about this, and I know it from a small standpoint. Pain can change your entire life in an instant. You know, what was important while you were prosperous, sometimes it doesn't mean a darn thing when we're in pain. Because all you can think about is, I want out of this pain. And I'm talking about my crooked back, of course, but that's nothing compared to Job. Nothing. He had boils from head to foot and thought he was terminal. And I'm sure a lot of you have suffered pain. And did it change your attitude, your outlook? You know, for me, it's easier to study the Bible when I'm hurting than when I'm not. If I'm not hurting and everything's going great, well, I spend time studying the Bible. You know, but if I'm hurting, I want to find out what God's going to do about it. And that's just Job. I mean, we all have a little of that in us, I think. I'm not sure. Maybe you don't. But pain can take your life and turn it right upside down. And that's especially true when it's applied to our value systems. As I said, what's important once, not anymore. Why does God respond to the cries for deliverance? Why does God not respond? Remember last time he said that there were rich people and there were oppressing the poor people to the point where the poor people were praying to God. Remember that? Now, the question comes up, well, why don't you listen to those poor people? Why doesn't God listen to them? You know, there are a couple of answers to this question. If you're in a bad situation and you cry out to God for deliverance and he's silent, how could that be a just God? That seems kind of cruel and unjust, doesn't it? And Job was thinking, you know, I didn't do anything to deserve this. Why are you doing this to me? Well, think about this. Think about a person who is selfish. Just a selfish person, happiest person in the world because he's rich, because he's selfish. And he's like Uncle Scrooge McDuck. He has money bins he plays in. And just the richest and happiest guy. And all of a sudden, he loses all of it. So what does he do? He's a poor man now. He cries out to God, God, please deliver me. I'm poor. I have to live in the dump. I have to ask for handouts. Why does he want to be delivered? Well, so he can go right back to being rich and happy. God will not respond to that. You know, if you're poor and miserable because you were rich and happy and lost it, and you want it back so you can be rich and happy again, God is not going to answer that. God knows that not every man wants to learn through pain. So if he's silent, it's because, you know, you're not going to understand anyway. You're going to say, God, why are you giving me this pain? And he won't tell you because he knows you won't understand. Because you don't want to be taught. God said, I'm giving you this pain so I can teach you a lesson. I don't want to learn the lesson. Forget the lesson, okay? I want to be pain-free again. So do you see why there are reasons why God is silent, apparently silent? He's not silent. He's given us the book of Job. But we have to study it. And there are reasons that we should not know why we are in pain. Remember when Satan was evaluating man in chapter 1 and 2? And Satan always said to God, you know, man, he doesn't love you for who you are. He loves you for what you give him. That's why God loves you. And these kind of guys are who Satan was talking about. He was correct about these guys. They don't love God. They love what God gives them. And I can't believe I watch television and here are people saying that that's what God does. That he gives you what you want. He doesn't cause any pain. He takes away all your pain. What nonsense. There's a lot of reasons we can suffer that we shouldn't know about. You know, man kind of wants to use God as a handyman. You ever notice that? Make life easy and comfortable. And that sells, boy, does that sell if you're a preacher. God wants you to be happy. He wants you to have money. He wants you to be wealthy. He wants you to be healthy. God does not respond to that. He is not our handyman to do what we want him to do. He's God. He's in control of the universe. And he darn well does what he wants to do. You know, I heard it said once and thought it was kind of funny. Man thinks of God as a spiritual aspirin tablet. You know, if I get in trouble spiritually, I'll pop a prayer up to God and he'll fix it. That's not God. God has a plan. How many people have you heard say, you know what? I'd really like to be taught something through pain. No, I haven't either. I've never said it. I never said, God, please, will you give me pain so I can learn the lesson? No, people don't ask that. They want a handyman. They want a God who says, God, I need a new garage. And if I send in $100 to this preacher, he says, I'll get my new garage. That's a business deal. That's nothing else. Nobody wants to learn through pain, but we do. Look at James chapter 4. If you think things have changed since Job wrote, and I believe Job is the oldest book in the Bible. I don't argue over that because I may be wrong, but Job was a long time back there. And he saw dinosaurs. And in James chapter 4, James chapter 4 and verse 3, you ask and do not receive. Why? Because you ask with the wrong motives, so that you may spend it on your pleasures. Exactly the same principle. Still in place in the New Testament, still in place today. If you ask God for money so you can, and you know, the classic example, Oh, Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes-Benz? That's the perfect example of exactly what this is talking about. God does not respond to prayers like that. My friends all drive Porsches. Tough. Suck it up. God isn't going to answer that prayer. So when this attitude is present, God answers with silence. And if the attitude stays present, things get tough. Because God has to get out his 2x4 and get your attention. This is for believers now. So the key to what Job has said, or what Elihu has said, is that in your bulletin? You can change it. The key to what Elihu said is the fact that Job sees God as an unjust and unfair, unwilling to explain what's going on. In chapter 34, verse 5 and 6, it says, "For Job has said, I am righteous. Should I lie concerning my right?" My right. He has a right to all this stuff. Why? Because he's righteous. I mean, he's the E.F. Hutton kind of guy. He earned it. That's a complete works mentality. You know, Job was not sinless. We discussed that time and time again. "Though I am without transgression, I was a good little boy. I earned all my money. What man is like Job who drinks up derision like water, who goes in company with the workers of iniquity and walks with wicked men?" That means he's so poor he can't even afford to walk with the righteous. Because remember, in their religion, in their tradition, in their theology, the measure of a person's righteousness was his wealth. Because if you were rich, that meant God favored you. And if you were poor, that meant God didn't favor you. So Job had to hang around with the people who God didn't favor in their theology. And that's what he's talking about there. I have to walk around with all of these sinners, you know, because God has taken away so much. Now, Job's attitude is going to change after God talks to him. Think of what's going on behind the scenes here. What's going on behind the scenes? Satan has announced a plan. He said, "God, I'm going to get somebody to curse you to your face. And what's the best way to accomplish that?" So Satan's working, his brain's just whizzing around like crazy, trying to figure a way to get Job to curse God to his face. So he takes all his wealth. Didn't work, darn. Have to think of something else. Takes away his whole family, his friends. That didn't work. Job didn't curse God. He had some misconceptions about God, but he did not curse God to his face. Okay, I'll take his health. I'll give him boils to rub off with broken jars at the dump. That didn't work. So what do you do? What do you do? I don't know. I'm not a terrific football fan. I like to watch a game once in a while. But, you know, what do coaches do when things start to go wrong? They go back to the playbook. Say, let's go back to the basics. And that's what Satan is doing here. He's going to go right back to his playbook from Genesis. What did he do in Genesis? In Genesis, he made Eve distrust God and believe that God was being unfair. Look at Genesis 3. And this is one of Satan's, it works. That's why he uses it so much. And that's why you hear so much when you tell people about your God, well, he's not fair. You know, because good people suffer and bad people prosper. And I've seen it, and God's not fair. Satan just got one. Because that's what he wants people to believe. And in Genesis 3:1, he says, "Now the serpent was more crafty than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made. And he said to the woman, 'Indeed, has God said, you shall not eat from any tree of the garden?'" So he put a little thought in her mind. Verse 4, he says, "The serpent said to the woman, 'You surely will not die.'" So God said, "If you eat from there, you'll die." "Oh, you will not." So what did he do? He's trying to make Eve distrust God and think he's not being fair. And in verse 5, it says, "For God knows that in the day you eat from it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil." So he's saying, you know, God has something he's keeping from you. He's not being fair and honest with you. Because if you eat from that tree, you won't die. In fact, just the opposite will happen. You'll gain something from it. You'll gain the knowledge of good and evil. So by making Job distrust God and calling him unfair, he's using exactly the same tactic that he used on Eve. And Elihu's answer is this: God is always true to his character. And that's important for us to remember too. God is always true to his character. 34:10 through 30, you can read those, all of those chapters or verses, and they talk about it in Job 34:10. "Therefore, listen to me, you men of understanding. Far be it from God to do wickedness, and from the Almighty to do wrong. For he pays a man according to his work, and makes him find it according to his way. Surely God will not act wickedly. The Almighty will not pervert justice." Now you have to take the long view here, but he's just saying God can't act out of character. He cannot be unfair. It's not in his character. In verse 10 and 12, he focuses on righteousness, and he says, "Therefore, listen to me, men of understanding, far be it from God to do wickedness." So he's getting around to the righteousness part, and Elihu argues that God's almighty power cannot be used to contradict his character. Can't do it. God is immutable. He cannot change. So Job here is in the process of learning. And he's learning one of the most difficult lessons that we ever have to learn as Christians. And if you want to be a happy Christian, you're going to have to learn this lesson, and it is tough. And that is learning to see what's good in what looks bad. We see something and it looks horrible, but we think, wait a minute, God can't act out of his character and do something horrible. That's got to be good. Where's the good in that? Romans 8:28, anybody? "And we know that God causes all things to work together for good to those who love God, to those who are the called according to his purpose." So if you're a believer, everything works together for the good of you as a group. Everything. So what's difficult about Romans 8:28? Is that hard to understand? Look at it. We know that God causes all things to work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called or the called according to His purpose. Is that hard to understand? Do you need an exegete to tell you what that means? No, anybody can understand. It's very easy to understand. The difficult part of Romans 8:28 is not what it says. It's easy to figure out what it says. I mean, I wouldn't even have to do an exposition of it if we were on Romans. I could just read it. You know what it means. The difficult part of Romans 8:28 is seeing the good in what to all intents and purposes looks bad. Or if you can't see it, believe that it's there. Because you look around and you see terrible things happen. Horrible things. World wars. How can a world war be good? Well, I can think of a reason for world war to be good. Because if it weren't for world wars, we'd probably all be living in dictatorships, and we'd probably all have no rights whatsoever. So, you know, something good came out of it. Was it horrible? My gosh, yes, it was horrible. But we have to look at everything like that. Not just, you know, these huge examples, but every little detail in our life that looks like it's bad is not. If you're a believer, it's working to the good. Now, we don't always know why. Our job is to believe it. So Elihu, he had this down. He knew this. And he's trying to communicate it to Job. So Elihu refutes Job. In verses 10 through 37. He goes to the defense of God's justice. So it seems almost like he's siding with the friends. But remember I said his approach is different? No, I don't think Elihu's theology is perfectly correct either. But he's kind of the warm-up act for God's speech that we'll look at next hour. Think of Elihu as a warm-up act for God, because he's getting Job's mind to work in a different way than it did before, with this rich equals righteous, poor equals sinful theology they have. Now Elihu comes along, and he's trying to get him to look at it differently. And for that, God did not reprimand him, even if he was incorrect in some of his statements. God did not reprimand him like he did the three friends. He did not make him ask Job to do a sacrifice for him. So Elihu's a good guy. He's the warm-up act for God. And, you know, nobody can follow God, so he's just a warm-up act. He says that, you know what, it'd be unthinkable that the just God would be unjust. And it's true. That doctrine is true. To do wrong would be contrary to God's nature. Did God take away Job's family? He allowed it to happen for a good cause, but he didn't do it. He can't. Because it would have been unfair. He gives a man exactly what he deserves. Verse 11 in 34. For he pays a man according to his work and makes him find it according to his way. He's completely impartial. Look at 16 to 20 in 34. But if you have understanding, hear this. Listen to the sound of my words. Shall one who hates justice rule? Shall one who hates and will you condemn the righteous mighty one? Who says to a king, worthless one, to noble, wicked ones? Who shows no partiality to princes, no regards the rich above the poor? For they are all the work of his hands. So God is totally impartial. God is the omniscient judge. Omniscient means he knows everything, everything. And he's the one who judges. So the judge sees everything. He knows all the facts. You go to a courtroom, you'll never get all the facts. Some of them are irrelevant, so they don't need to be known. God knows them all, even if they are irrelevant. God knows everything. He knows all the facts, and he's the one that judges. So you can trust God's judgment. And that's what Elihu is saying through this section. He's saying, you know, God is trustworthy. He invented justice. He is justice. He cannot do unjust things. Did you ever hear the old expression, secret sin on earth is open scandal in heaven? God knows everything. I remember this on a television show, and a couple of guys were talking about doing something. I don't even remember what it was. He said, but God's going to see you do that. And the guy said, well, no, I'm going to be in the van. It's got a roof. No, that doesn't work. God is the absolute executor. He executes justly. He executes justice. Only justice. He cannot execute anything else. But if God keeps quiet, now in verse 29 of 34, it says that when he keeps quiet, who can condemn? When he hides his face, who can behold him? That is in regard to both nation and man. So nations can't see him. Man can't see him. He's quiet and he's chosen to be so. And the reason I say that, if God keeps quiet, and keeps quiet is what's called in Hebrew a hifil stem. What that means is that it's an inner causation. Isn't that edifying? An inner causation. What it means is he decided it himself. He decided to be silent. So he hides his face. He keeps quiet towards evil men. And he doesn't act against injustice as soon as man thinks he should. That's the idea. Man thinks you should, and especially these guys, if you do something wrong, zap. Now, during the millennial kingdom, that will be the case. But we're not in the millennial kingdom, nor was Job. So there's often a time gap. So it is not our place to question him. If we see something that's absolutely unjust, if it's illegal, we report it to the police. But say it's legal, and God doesn't do anything about it, it's not our place to question God. That's not our place. He may have a plan. Did you hear what I just said? God may have a plan. God has a plan. And he will carry it out. And it's not our place to question that plan. So the bottom line is God will not allow godless men to rule or ensnare people endlessly. Verse 30. So that godless men would not rule nor be snares of the people. And that's just after the verse we just read, 29, when he keeps quiet, he He decides to keep quiet and not do anything right now. When he hides his face, then who can behold him? Nations, men, nobody. So that godless men would not rule, nor be snares of the people. So he can hide his face and do it later. He's going to do it. Justice will be done. As we all know, justice will be done. Every sin has been paid for. Everyone. Every single one, from Job through Revelation, through us, through the future, every sin has been paid for. God is a just God, and he can't be an unjust God. Okay, we'll start here next hour. Father, thank you for the book of Job. In Christ's name, amen.